McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit diplomatic.
News. Can you design?
Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You are listening to Unfit to Print, the McGill Daily's very own radio show. Unfit to Print is a bi-weekly show made in cooperation with CKUT 90.3 FM. All work is produced by student contributors who strive to push the limits of radio journalism, bringing you original and engaging content that explores and reflects our community. My name is Ali, and I am the multimedia editor at the Daily. If you are interested in radio or video journalism and want to get involved with creating multimedia content for the McGill Daily, shoot us an email at multimedia@mcgilldaily.com. No experience is required to get involved. We'll teach you everything you need to know. Now, moving on to the show. On today's program, we get a sneak peek of next week's Daily in Print feature article, a conversation with Syrian journalism student Ayed Herrera, about his time living in Syria during phase one of the civil war and the process of moving to Canada. But first, is our economic model to blame for the climate crisis? Well, award-winning journalist and best-selling author Naomi Klein thinks so. Her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, serves as a wake-up call to the current state of our environment. The McGill Daily's Will Mazurek sat down with Naomi Klein last Tuesday at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel.
So first off, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. Just sort of as an opener, you referenced the term radical change a lot in your new book, and I'm just wondering if you can explain to us what is radical change? What's the difference between a change being radical and not?
Well, radical means getting at the root. I think that, you know, that's part of it, is actually trying to get at root causes. So, you know, switching from coal to another fossil fuel, you know, natural gas, is not a radical change. It's change, but it's definitely not getting at the root of the problem. But it's also just the depth and speed of the change that we need to make if we're going to be guided by science. And this is a crisis that, if we had responded when we first found out about it, when there was first scientific consensus, there could have been a slower, gradual approach. But I quote Michael Mann in the book, saying there's a procrastination penalty, and we have procrastinated for more than two decades, and during that time we've made the problem a lot worse. So now we find ourselves on a very tight deadline.
What do you think is the biggest issue that the general public currently faces when it talks about climate change? Why is current climate discourse not effective?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. Most of it is just the dissonance between, you know, reading these really scary stories in the newspaper, scientific warnings that would make you rationally believe that the culture that you're in would be acting as if it was in the middle of an emergency, right? So there's this real dissonance between getting that scary information and living in a culture that is acting as if nothing is wrong. You know, and even when you have politicians who pay lip service to the problem and do use, like John Kerry called climate change a weapon of mass destruction, but if you look at what the Obama administration is doing, you know, they are engaging in an arms race. You know, they're doubling down on fossil fuels. They're not moving away from them. So I think that that's the biggest problem. It's not that people don't understand that there's a crisis. It's that you can only hold a problem that big in your head if there's not a credible response to it for so long. And so that's why I sort of describe this on again, off again relationship that we have with climate information. It's like you look away, you get really scared, and then you sort of. I think we have to tell ourselves stories that explain why we're doing nothing in the face of this crisis. So it must not be that serious if we're acting as if we have all this time. Or we must not be out of time if we're acting that way. So you know, that's how that's how our brains are designed to resolve cognitive dissonance. So I think that if our political actions, I think it's less a communication problem than it is an action problem. I think if our actions were in line with our communication, then we would be able to look at this and we would be less afraid of it. But it is really scary to be told there's a problem and to have no credible way up, right?
So with that in mind, do you think the general public is led astray by the notion of a green consumer, that climate action can come from the individual as opposed to a society?
I don't think people believe that anymore. You know, I think that that's what we were told, you know, in the sort of inconvenient truth era of environmentalism. It's like, yeah, change your light bulb, offset your emissions. But I actually find, you know, just like the book just came out today, but I've been talking about it, you know, for a couple of weeks. And I think the biggest issue, honestly, is that people just think we're screwed, and that they know we've wasted decades on these sort of consumer non-responses. And, you know, I know, like, Quebec is having a big debate about recycling at the moment, you know, but people know, like, the tar sands is the reason why our emissions are, you know, 27% higher than what they should be under Kyoto. It's not because people are putting their yogurt in the wrong box, you know. I don't think the issue is that we think we're going to do this through consumerism. I think it's that we don't think there is a solution, because worse than leading us down this sort of green consumerism path, the people who in our culture who talk most about the science and talk most about climate action are so committed to being non-political, non-ideological, non-partisan, that they don't talk about the political barriers in the way of action. And they get really uncomfortable when you talk about, you know, neoliberalism, let alone capitalism. Because there's still this idea that they're going to sell this to the right, and we have to be really, we're going to be sneaky, and we're going to somehow hide the fact that this takes, you know, a huge government response and regulation if we're going to take this seriously.
So with that in mind, what solutions are there other than those which involve a free market in dealing with climate change?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that markets have a role in a response. You know, I think, you know, there are. There are amazing solar energy companies like Sungevity that are making solar power affordable to millions of people. But acknowledging that is not the same as saying we can leave this to the market, right? Because those sort of incentives alone are not going to be enough. You also have to regulate. You have to say no to fossil fuels. You need to fight for policies like, no, but just a straight up ban on Arctic drilling, like close that frontier. I think we need to think about closing off carbon frontiers, like because we're doing the opposite. We're opening up new carbon frontiers at exactly the moment when we need to be going in the other direction. So, you know, we have had campaigns to save the rainforest. Why can't we have a campaign, you know, a successful campaign, because there are campaigns to keep the Arctic drilling free and to wind down the tar sands. And we have movements like this. So, you know, the movements that have won moratoriums and bans on fracking, for instance, the movements that are, you know, stalling or stopping pipelines, that have already blocked numerous coal export terminals, that are finding these choke points. So that's happening. One of the most inspiring examples of how we can respond to this, but it does take challenging the sort of free market logic, is Germany's transition to renewable energy, which is happening really, really quickly. 25% of the country is now powered by wind and solar. But what's really interesting is that this is a big part of this process has been cities and towns deciding to take back control over their energy systems from the private companies that they had sold them to in the 90s. So they're reversing privatization. It's a direct challenge to neoliberalism, and that's what, you know, the big part of what is allowing the transition.
And sort of lastly, I just want to touch on the idea of activism. Some argue activism has really more of a symbolic than a concrete value. Obviously, activists don't make up the bulk of the general population. And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, is activism an effective solution to implement the kind of changes necessary to make a climatically friendly economy? Or are you not optimistic about its potential?
Well, I think that the change that we need is so deep and so rapid that the only precedents that could point to are moments in history where activism stopped being something that was just like a, you know, small subculture engaging in symbolic acts, and became a society-wide project of transformation. We saw that in the midst of the Great Depression, with the huge public engagement that led to the New Deal and many of the social programs in the U.S. and in Canada that we're very proud of today. It happened during both world wars, where it was sort of like the whole society comes together and said, you know, it's not like this is, you know, the line between activists and regular people totally blurs, and it becomes everybody. And there were moments in the civil rights fight that were like that, and those moments in history where of extraordinary public engagement when societies really changed very rapidly. But I think the story we tell ourselves about ourselves is we're much too atomized, we're much too self-interested. You know, activism is just something that other people do. So really, this is a battle over who we are, whether we believe in the public sphere, whether we only see ourselves as consumers, or whether we're something else, whether we're going to create more spheres for sustained public engagement. Because, you know, without that, I don't see a way to deal with a crisis that stems from having such a powerful entrenched elite defending its interests, right? I mean, we're up against the most powerful and rich forces, you know, in the history of money. You know, they're not going to give this up without a fight. I mean, there may be, you know, meetings at the UN where the head of, you know, Bank of America gets together with, you know, the CEO of Suez, and everyone's very concerned about climate change. But the point is, this model is incredibly profitable for a small elite, and they're going to defend that. And the only thing that can take on that kind of entrenched wealth, and the only thing that ever has, is a massively engaged population. You know, that's why I think people read the book, and some people feel inspired, you know, because they can imagine that, and some people go, that'll never happen, you know, and it's really about what we think we're capable of. And, you know, I don't know the answer to that any better than you do, you know, because we surprise ourselves in the street.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us anyway. Anyways, we really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you very much.
That was an interview with bestselling author Naomi Klein on her new book, This Changes Everything: Capitalism versus the Climate. The book was released last week and is already garnering great reviews. Now moving on to our next piece. The Syrian civil war has led to a humanitarian crisis, with the number of Syrian refugees now topping 3 million and a further 6.5 million displaced within Syria, according to the UN. The feature piece for next week's edition of The Daily focuses on Syrian journalism student Ayed Herrera, who recently moved to Montreal. McGill Daily contributor Yasmin Masiman sat down with Ayed to talk about his last few years living in Syria, his time in Lebanon, and the process of moving to Canada.
My name is Yasmin Masiman, and I'm here with Ayed Herrera. Ayed has recently moved to Canada from Syria and is residing here in Montreal. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I moved here to Canada, not from Syria, directly to Canada. I was living in Beirut for the last 2 years. Yeah, I was living in Beirut. Before that, I was working and living in Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I arrived in Canada before 4 months.
Tell us a little bit about growing up in Syria. You said before that you grew up in Damascus.
Yeah, I born in Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to school in Damascus, and graduated from the high school in also Damascus. University, I spent 3 years in journalism and media section in University of Damascus, and I couldn't complete, so I...
Because of?
Yeah. The last year I couldn't because the war, the revolution over there. The half of Syrian are...
Dispersed, yeah,
out of Syria. So, and actually we are not living in the same planet, in another planet.
Yeah. And where did you publish these articles?
There was a website called All for Syria. Yeah, it was the famous this website since 2002, I think. It belonged to Mr. Ayman Abdel Noor. He's engineering. Mm-hmm. He was studying in Syria. Mm-hmm. And in the first period of the president, it was the reform period, as they say. This man, who is the manager of this website, was working inside the Syria, mm-hmm. and trying to appear some freedom or liberty or something like that. Mm-hmm. But just a few days or few months later, a lot of educated young people put in the jail, and nothing has been changed. So this website, actually I wrote don't know how many articles, not too much, mm-hmm. not too many, but it's don't know. And this is in the first period. After that, no, I stopped.
Okay.
After actually the last of 2011, after the revolution changed to the armed revolution, when they got weapon.
Yeah, and you were telling me before we started our interview a bit about your last class at university in Syria.
Yeah.
So
it was in the July 2012,
mm-hmm.
the last week in July, I was attending the, I forgot the name of the subject, and the battles around the university, bombing here, bombing there, your desk shaking, and you can hear nearly the sound of fire shooting by Kalashnikov.
Mm-hmm.
You can see by your eyes the military and the intelligence member surrounding, checking the people, checking the students, who is in, who is out. Yeah, and it was so stressed and so scary over there. You can see the smoke all over the sky. Yeah, it was the last day. It was remaining one also subject, mm-hmm. but it's cancelled, the university cancelled, and I moved to Lebanon the next day.
And were the bombings, were they reported in the media? Were they?
No.
No?
Nothing. Because it was not allowed in the first period,
mm-hmm.
Not allowed to any media in the world to mm-hmm. get in. After some month, the supporting regime media just came in, also it's not works with the regime, because they are reporting what they think is good, but it's not good for the regime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the official channels of Syria, since it's nothing. They have a slogan over there, like it's done, it's finished. In the first period, no nothing, there is nothing, just propaganda from here and there, the enemies, Israel, America, you know, this stuff.
Moving to Beirut, what were you doing in Beirut?
I moved to Beirut in 2011, in October or
mm-hmm.
November.
Mm-hmm.
I got cancelled in Dubai
mm-hmm.
after the revolution began. Actually, out of Syria, had cancellation from
cancellation from a job or
from the job school? And the visa.
Okay, visa.
Yeah.
By the government.
In all the Arabian Gulf
okay.
countries.
Okay.
So Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and. A lot of Syrians faced this. After the cancellation, I moved to Beirut. Actually, nothing in Beirut, just spent time to move to Canada.
And Tell me a little bit of what it's like being a Syrian, living in Beirut as a Syrian, because I've been to Lebanon before, like after the crisis has started, and I know there's like a lot of tension right now between Syrians and Lebanese.
Yeah. Actually, the crisis between Syria and Lebanon, it's from, I think, more than 30 years ago, mm-hmm. 35, since 76.
Yeah.
The Lebanese got so sensitive from the strong neighbor, Syria. And after that, becoming to be more sensitive about the Syrian people also. Now, actually, because of all of this, you saw what you saw in what you see in the television about the they are attacked some Syrian, and they Syrian cannot do anything in Lebanon. Just they are running away from the war in Syria.
Yeah, and there are over how many million are there in there now?
There
the in Lebanon. In Lebanon.
Yeah, UN said in the end of 2013, it was around 900,000 or more. This is not real because not all the Syrian
are documented.
Yeah, not documented.
And your family, are they still in Syria?
No, they are here.
They're all of them?
Yeah.
Okay, so you know your parents, your wife, your
yeah. My parents and my wife. Actually, I got married in the first of this year.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you. after the exception of Canada,
mm-hmm.
after we passed the interview in
mm-hmm.
in Canadian embassy in Beirut,
mm-hmm.
and after we got approved,
you met her in Syria or Lebanon?
No, Lebanon.
Lebanon.
Yeah.
Okay. Is she Syrian as well?
Yeah.
And do you still know people that are in Syria right now?
I have people there. Yeah. I have a lot of friends, a lot of cousins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, over there. I'm in touch with them.
Yeah.
Actually, every day.
They're in Damascus?
Yeah.
Okay. And what are they telling you from what's happening right there right now?
No need to, because they feel scary to say anything on the phone.
Yeah.
Or on the Skype or anything.
Yeah.
No need to tell me because I can hear what is happening there.
What do you mean?
Actually, the fighter plane can hear the sound of the fighter plane, and you can hear the rockets of this, you can hear the bombing, you heard me. A lot of weapons, and they can tell you this is rocket, this one bomb, this one from the fighter plane.
Yeah,
it's a lot in this time. It's so sensitive. A lot of battles going on now around the capital and inside,
mm-hmm.
not inside. In the side of the
city?
Around me, yeah.
Yeah.
The first inside.
And so, how is your family and you? How have you guys been settling into Canada?
Yeah, we like to we like the the first thing that you feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And. The second thing that you feel that you can say whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
and you can feel that you are human here. I am living in near to Guan,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and now I'm studying French courses.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm planning to improve my English because it's so bad.
Oh, it's very good.
Yeah. to complete my study in Concordia for now.
Journalism, right?
Yeah, journalism, of course. I am in 30 years old.
Okay.
And I feel like I lost a lot of things. I should be here from 15 years old. maybe from the beginning. Yeah, so I have a heavy duty to do.
Thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you.
Me too.
That was a conversation between Syrian journalism student Ayed Herrera and McGill Daily contributor Yasmin Mossiman. The piece will be in next week's edition of The Daily, so make sure to pick it up. In the meantime, why not pick up this week's edition of The Daily that just hit stands yesterday? Well, that does it for this episode of Unfit to Print. Thank you to Yasmin and Will for their pieces this week. And finally, the multimedia section of The Daily is looking for contributors. If you are interested in radio or video journalism, if you want to help put this show together, if you have ideas to make it better, please email us at multimedia@mcgilldaily.com. No experience is required to get involved.
Unfit to Print.